You know, Jack Marshall and I are working on a book now, The History of Jazz, from the time of jazz at Amoeba Jazz to the new thermonuclear jazz. And this is a chapter of jazz in the 16th century at Stratford-on-Avon. Irving Lancelot was 42 years old, and he never had a job. And he used to sleep real late in the morning. And he used to go to bed real early at night. And he just liked that. And his mother was a charwoman up at the Duke's castle with the moat around it. And anyway, one day his mother came home and said, "Irving, you gotta get a job. This is horrible. Laying in bed and everything. Join a crusade." Get a drive-in armor wash or something. Maybe you could design dungeons or anything. Don't limit yourself, you know. And Irving said, "Well, yeah, but Ma, I got my dream. The Stratford-on-Avon Jazz Festival." She says, "Yeah, but this is just a tiny town. They don't even like jazz here. Just polkas and country music and stuff." Irving says, "Yeah, it is a drag. I gotta go to London where all the swingers are." And his mother says, "Yes, that's right." And just then, she stuck her gnarled old hand in a niche in the fireplace and pulled out a handful of banknotes, her life savings. And she gave them to Irving and said, "Go to London, Irving. I know you can make it." And Irving looked at her and a big tear came in his eye. Says, "Damn, you got a gnarled old hand." And so he took the money anyway, and he left right away. I think pride stopped him from thanking her. And that night he was on the Champagne stagecoach to London. It's about 70 miles, I guess, and this was real fast. It took 14 days and 27 nights. Ooh, but it was good. And everybody juiced on the stagecoach. The driver juiced, and the ladies in waiting juiced. And after a few drinks, you didn't really have to wait too long. The footman, the handman, and the noseman drank. Everybody drank. But Irving got the loadedest of anybody. And he really started bugging everybody. He started grabbing the stewardess's bodice. And he wanted to drive the stagecoach, so he was really bugging everybody. As it was the stagecoach driver's custom, he hit Irving on the head and rolled him. And dumped him out in a ditch. And 2 days later, Irving woke up with a horrible hangover. And he saw the Blood Pudding Inn across the street there. And he hoped that Red Norville was playing there, so so he could borrow a few guineas, you know. But there was a crazy band there. And the place was wigging out and swinging and everybody was going crazy. And it was a band, let me see, there was a Tory, a wig, and a wig out, and an eccentric nobleman with a speech impediment. And the Tory played the harpsichord, and the wig played the viola da gamma. And the wig out played the fipple flute. It was good right there. And the eccentric nobleman with the speech impediment played the electric guitar. Which was really good because there was no electricity or anything. He was really ahead of his time, this guy. Well. But the way he did it, he had a real long cord on his amplifier. And he used to wrap it around. So anyway, Irving signed him up right away, you know. And they were an overnight smash. And they played at everything. They played at beheadings and... witch burnings. And at the Hundred Years' War, they played the troops off. And they played joustings and roustings. And it was great. And Irving loved them. He called them the Medieval Jazz Quartet. Now, most agents take 10%, but not all Irv. He said, what would I do without the boys? If it wasn't for them, I'd be broke. Back there at Mom's. I gotta, you know. So he took everything. Because, you know, the musicians would squander it anyway. And he made a lot of loot, you know. So he built himself a real crazy castle with a great big picture window. Looking out over the Thames and... That's what he wanted to see, the Thames. And it was beautiful. One side looked over the Thames, the other of Chavez Ravine. And right across the street was a lot of wonderful dykes. Oh, it was wonderful. It was a beautiful palace. Anyway, he says, I gotta get Mom. What the hell? I'll get Mom to come. Maybe I can fix her gnarled old hand. Anyway. So he wrote her a letter and told her to come on. He didn't send her a ticket. He thought the walk would be good for her. Anyway, she was walking there. And all of a sudden, Irving knew that he didn't have a moat around his castle. And he didn't know what to do. I don't have no moat, man. This is horrible. Got a lot of dykes across the street, though. I gotta get a moat some way. My mother will be here in about 2 hours. And just then, the eccentric nobleman with the speech impediment stepped up and said, Irving, we dig you the moat. Incidentally, I'm a rat expert, you know, and I know all about rats. They do great things with rats now, you know, in the research laboratories. With the little electrodes they hook to their heads, they can satisfy their hunger urge and their drinking urge and their sex urge. And they took one rat and sent him out, and they put the electrodes on his head and sent him out, and he got close to a wall, and they pushed a button and satisfied his sex urge, you know. So... he came back and he said, oh, man, that was crazy. And the other rat said, well, what'd she look like? He says, oh, I don't know, something like a wall, but... And they're gonna fix these things up, you know, like those old 4 for a quarter photograph booths you could go in, you know, and draw the curtain and... They're going to fix them up and put these electrode booths, you know, in the train stations and bus stations, you know, and everywhere. And then you'll just go in and put your quarter in and you set the dial at a whatever you like, you know. A 17-year-old redhead or a 19-year-old blonde. A 60-year-old gray-headed lady. Or a nice old man, whatever you like. The guys do fight over the settings, though. Had a lot of trouble, because one guy goes in and he puts a lot of quarters in that 17-year-old redhead thing, you know. Because, geez, I spent a lot of money on her, man. That's my chick. Don't use that setting. One sailor did have a bad experience with it in the experimental model due to a faulty transistor. He was trapped for 27 hours in a booth with a 17-year-old redhead setting, you know. But they are going to give him a full military funeral.
Gym class for 2 years with only one sock, because when you're out of class you don't remember it that you lost one, and then you get to class and it's only one sock. It's horrible. In the high school election for president of my class, I lost the election to a guy who now works getting money out of wishing wells, because he has real long thin arms and he sticks them down through the screen. Anyway, folks, it seems like I was just born to lose. In the Nixon-Kennedy election, I voted for Henry Wallace and his progressive jazz party. One time at Santa Anita, I lost the keys to my car and had to walk home. One sweat sock. It was horrible. And then when I got home, that Chinaman was waiting there with a... And he had a whole lot of big Chinaman guys. They really hit me a lot right in the nose. Now you get tired. You say you were through. Born to lose, and now I'm losing you. Yeah, now I'm losing you.
jazz book, you know, the history of jazz. And this is a chapter of it, from our book, The History of Jazz from the Time of the Amoeba to the Present Day Thermonuclear Jazz. And this is about jazz at the time of the amoeba. And it was hard to find out anything about it because any records just sounded real scratchy. Had a horrible surface noise on them. But I did delve into the Library of Congress, and I loved delving there because they had a lot of crazy, cute librarians. And I gleaned a lot of knowledge, but the gleaning wasn't as good as the delving, though. And I found out that the main style of jazz during the time of the amoeba was real slippery and wiggly and wet. And the bands then were real big. They were huge bands. The Amoeba Brothers had a band. There was about 4,000 Amoeba Brothers in this band. And they were a smash, you know. They played everywhere. They played at puddles, little pools and sewers and everything. They were the greatest, you know. But then one of the Amoeba Brothers wanted to quit the road. And he wanted to stay home and practice flamingo guitar and play records and look at a lot of TV and everything. Or no, they didn't have that. Whatever they did, and look at a rock or something. But anyway, the rest of the brothers didn't want him to quit, you know. And he says, well, I got a real good protozoa. I'll send him in as a sub. But the other brother said, oh, man, you know how those guys are. They try and take over the band. And they'll try and get a lot of protozoas in the band. And they'll start auditioning the girl singers. And, you know, they'll want to play their tunes, and it'll be horrible. But he says, well, I gotta quit. I hate this road. I mean, jumping from puddle to puddle, it's horrible. I gotta quit. I can't go on with this. I want to raise a family. And then he split. I got a new thing that I do. I hunt with a falcon. And it's real good. All you need is a falcon and a big glove. You do need a big, thick glove, though, because the falcon will rip right at your arm and sever your artery. That's something horrible. Anyway, you set the falcon up there on your knuckles, and there's a few positions that you can use to hunt in. The most favorite one is like this. You know, with your eyes covered, you should keep the eyes covered at all times. They love eyes, and they'll go right for your eyes. And you cover your eyes, and you put the falcon up there, and then you give the command, hunt. And unless he just ate or something, he'll fly away. But don't look right away, though. Wait, they'll go right for your eyes, yeah. And if he does go and hunt, follow him real close, because if they do get some game, they'll eat it right away. They will leave the head, though, but they'll eat the eyes out of them. They love eyes. Have to get there right away. One thing that's nice about it, you can join a falcon club, you know, and meet a lot of nice guys. And you meet every once a month there, and you go in, and the guy says, how's your bird? That's the main thing that I like about it. I just stand around and have everybody, how's your bird? One thing about a falcon, though, you have to feed them at home, because if they get hungry at your house, they start making a horrible noise, a squawking, you know. And they eat dead rats. So, and it's hard to get a dead rat right off the bat, I think. You know. So I got a lot of dead rats and froze them. Right in the freezer there, you know. It's like a Falcons TV dinner. It's real good. They love it next to eyes. They love that. And one thing, you do have to have a return whistle when you send him out to hunt, and you got to get him back some way. And this is mine. And you don't look right away either. Wait till he gets back, because they'll fly right into your eyes. Real fast. And one thing, you can't use another guy's whistle, or you could wind up with two birds. That would be good at the club, though. How's your birds? Mm-hmm. Anyway, and you got to watch out where you hunt, too. You can't hunt in female falcon-infested areas. You wouldn't want to anyway, but... One time I had a stud falcon who was a... They're known to be curly-headed devils, so... They'll fly away with anything. Anyway, I was out hunting with him one time, gave the command, hunt. And he took off and flew around with some other birds, and I gave him the whistle. And he didn't come back. He flew away. So I was in the bar later at the Falcon Club, and I said, oh, man, my bird flew away with the female falcon. And I says, I think it was a female falcon, but I don't know. How do you tell them apart? And the guy says, oh, I don't know. Oh, that's too bad. And then just then, down at the end of the bar, a guy stood up and says, I know. Oops, I'm a bird expert. I says, well, how do you do it? How do you tell him? He says, well, the female falcon will only eat the female dead rat. And the male falcon will only eat the male dead rat. Says, oh, that's good. How do you tell them rats apart? The guy says, oh, I don't know. I'm just a bird expert. I don't know about rats. Ladies and gentlemen, the last of the great fun wars. Folks, you know, nowadays, war is better than ever, it's true, but actually it won't be much fun anymore. You just sit in your living room and get blown up. Of course. Anyway, there's none of the good weapons left, like the M1 rifle or the flamethrower. At least the flamethrower got you hot before you died.
World War II was a funny war, the greatest more or less. It really was a million laughs if you didn't mind the mess.
Neville Chamberlain stepped off the British Airways airplane and he said, hello, I just got a paper here. Saying that Herr Hitler will have peace in our time. Boom! Oops, there went Westminster Abbey. The world was at war. France fell in 18 days, thereby setting a world record for falling. Meanwhile, England hung on.
England hung on.
In the United States, war was in the air. The songwriters were trying to predict where the attack would be so they could get a hit record. There was one wonderful tune, The Sky Was Red at Lake Arrowhead. And they came up with, Oh, How We Swam When They Bombed Boulder Dam. And in San Francisco,
Remember the Golden Gate Bridge? It sure was a dandy. Remember the Golden Gate Bridge. If you crossed the bay, it really came in handy.
That fateful day, December 7th, an alert PFC calls up his commanding officer. Hello, I'd like to talk to my commanding officer. I'm alert PFC, and could I talk to the CO, please?
What are you bothering me for, you nut? Don't you know I'm at a luau?
Well, but sir, they're...
Now, honey, bring me another one of those Navy grogs there.
Listen,
Dance tell a story when they dance, you know.
There's Japanese planes coming. I mean, it's terrible. They're attacking us.
How do you know they're Japanese planes, you dumb nut?
Well, I can see a lot of garden hose hanging out of them. And a lot of lawnmowers and automatic trimming edgers and everything. And they're bombing us, and a lot of guys are getting mad. And, I mean, it's horrible.
Well, give the barracks a good cleaning. We don't want to get bombed with a dirty barracks, and I'll be right over.
Oh, thanks a lot. Oh, I remember that day well. I was drafted and I was enlisted. And I remember saying goodbye to my childhood sweetheart, Wanda. I'd loved her all through school. High school, corrective school, reform school. I hated her out of school. I loved her in school. Anyway, she was seeing me off down there at the draft board. And I hugged her and kissed her, and then I walked out. And I turned around to wave, and I noticed she was hugging and kissing everybody else there. But she always was a sport. Meanwhile, England staunchly hung on.
England staunchly hung on.
And I joined the Fighting 89th. It was terrible. I remember it was ridiculous. We wiped out a town, a village, a hospital, a lot of trucks, a hospital ship, everything, an orphanage, a convent. Oh, it was horrible. And we weren't even overseas yet. And then one day, my CO called me into the office.
Come in here, Sheldon. We want to place you correctly now. We want the right man in the right job for this war. That's the only way we can win. Now, tell us, what can you do? What are your qualifications?
Well, I can arrange music and play the trumpet, and I'm real good and way behind the lines in shows and special services and good stuff and mopping and everything, clerical work I can do.
Well, that sounds real good. I think we'll make you a paratrooper and drop you in Europe
Oh, but don't you think it'd be better to let one of the poor kids go and see it? I've been there, I mean. And when I fly, my lips get all chapped. And...
No, we're going to drop you there, and here's a ring. You see this nice ring, and it has a vial of poison in it. And you just pop that right in your mouth, and you'll be gone in case they capture you, so you're not tortured.
A ring with poison in it? You just take it if you... I never usually wear rings or a wristwatch or anything, but... Just then I slowly turned and very suddenly and violently began to vomit. England courageously hung on.
England courageously hung on.
And they did make me a paratrooper and drop me behind the enemy lines, and there I was fighting in the trenches. It was snowing, it was horrible. I was fighting there for about 3 weeks with one other guy. I used to sit real low down in the trench and shoot straight up. I like to look busy and everything, you know. I like that a lot. And then, I noticed one day we were fighting for about 3 weeks, and I noticed it was Christmas Day. And all of a sudden, down the line, I heard in a soft voice, Ach, lieben dein Spitzer, Ach, frieken dein Laugen, Hast denn da unten frei?
Wash den Spiegel, dein Sitzer. And I knew it was Silent Night. And I looked up over the trench. In case there's any falcons around. They love eyes, they'll go right for your eyes. Anyway, I looked up there and I looked across and I saw a guy with a waving a white handkerchief or some panties or something. I don't know what it was. But anyway, I cautiously walked over there and he had a bottle of brandy, you know. And he was a young kid. I know Hitler must have been, you know, really hung up because the kid was only 15 or 16, I know. He didn't shave, I know, because I rubbed against his cheek. But it was cold as hell out there. It's really cold, and be out there 3 weeks, you know, your values change. All alone, you know. So anyway, I looked at him, and I thought, geez, the guy's just like me. He's probably got a girl home, like Wanda. Some freak in Stuttgart. I thought, geez, what a crazy war. Then I took the last drink out of the bottle and shot him. And I got a medal for shooting the most guys on Christmas Day. I shot 4 Germans, 3 Italians, and 2 of our guys. But sitting down in the trench, you don't know who the hell you're shooting. I shoot straight up. Anyway, England did hang on.
England did hang on.
And they gave me a 3-day pass in Paris, finally. And there I was. I was on the railroad platform there. I wanted to see everything, be a regular tourist. See the UN building, Chavez Ravine, those wonderful dikes I'd heard about. See everything, you know. Oh, I love that city of the Seven Hills, and I hoped maybe I could catch Red Norbo at the hot club. Anyway, suddenly I saw her. Hands thrust deeply in her trench coat pockets, wearing a beret at a jaunty angle. And she was beautiful. I didn't know what to do. She looked like a saint. I fell in love with her right then, but I was afraid to talk to her because I don't know what to do. And then she solved that problem by coming up and saying, "Hey, baby, 2 packs of cigarettes. I'll show you everything in Paris." Right away, I knew what she was. A guide. Anyway, I said, "I don't have no cigarettes. I don't smoke." And she said, "Well, 2 candy bars. I'll show you everything in Paris. Come on." I said, "I don't have any candy. Besides, it's real bad for your teeth." And just then, she smiled, and her teeth were horrible. And all rotten. And I knew she'd got a lot of candy bars and showed a lot of guys around there. Anyway, I didn't care. I took her to a little sidewalk cafe, and we sat down, and then she took off her beret at a jaunty angle. And I noticed that her head was shaved. And I got up and kicked her and spit on her and slapped her. And I said, "I know what you are. You're a collaborator." And she says, "No, don't. It's all right. I'm naturally bald. Sit down." So anyway, I sat down and I felt lousy and guilty and horrible. And I hung my head. And I don't want to sound conceited, but I know that she loved me because right away she started asking me warm personal questions like, "How many guys in your outfit? And when are you going to make the big push? Have you got any big guns?" And I told her everything. And then she did a singularly curious thing. She took a pigeon out of her stocking.
And then she wrote a little note and tied it to its leg and let it go, and it went right for my eyes. I love eyes. I beat it off, though, anyway. And it flew away. And then I felt horrible. I thought about Wanda, and I got up and left. And I went back, and a singularly curious thing, my outfit was completely wiped out. Meanwhile, in the Pacific, the same thing was happening. Hirohito was on his knees. Tojo was on his knees. Hirohito's little white horse was on his knees.
No, they're just real short.
They look like they're on their knees. They're very short, though. Look like it to me, I don't know. Anyway, on this big battleship, the big aircraft carrier, the Fukushima, a little admiral comes in and he's walking on his knees.
No, he's just another...
Oh, he's just short. He looked like he's... and he came and he said he had the cream of the Japanese Air Force there, and he said, okay, boys, now we're going to make a little last desperate push now, and we're going to load up the planes. This will give you guys a good chance to show that you're a good sport about this whole thing, and, you know, you want to do the right thing. We're going to load up all the planes there with broken glass and beer bottles and a lot of garbage and horrible stuff, you know. A lot of lawnmowers and garden hoes and automatic tourniquets. We'll put them right in front, you know. And then you take off, and you just fly up, and you aim your plane right for the American boats, and you fly right into them. And stay right in the plane, and just go there and sink them, and you die. But you show that you're a good sport, though. And we call this kamikaze. In Japanese, that means good sport. And England hung on.
England hung on.
Meanwhile, I was back in a trench in Germany there, writing a letter to my sweetheart, Wanda. Dear beloved Wanda, I'm writing you a letter to let you know that I'm sitting in a cold, wet, muddy trench. And a lot of the guys think I'm a little goofy because the war has been over about 3 weeks. And they're sitting in the barracks and all having a ball. But I really like it out here in the cold, wet, muddy trench. And I love to rub the mud in my eyes and all. It's really good, and I love it when it rains. Anyway, England hung on.
England hung on.
Meanwhile, out in the Pacific on the Old Mole, MacArthur was there signing the treaty. And he took the Japanese envoy aside and whispered something in his ear. And no one ever knew what it was that he whispered in his ear, but I happened to know it was, could you get me a deal on one of those little Sony television sets?
World War II was a funny war, the greatest more or less. It really was a million laughs if you did.